Good morning. I'm Joe Zappala from the Cornell University ILR School, and we'd like to welcome you to another ILR online webcast program. Today, we're pleased to launch a new series, ILR on Policy, and we'll be coming back to you a few times during the year featuring a conversation with a policy leader. Today, that person is Seth Harris, and in a moment, I'll be turning this over to ILR School Dean Harry Katz, who will introduce Seth and begin our conversation. We would like to invite you to submit questions during today's webcast, and let me tell you how to do that. You'll see me right now on a screen, and if you look above that TV screen, you'll see some icons. And find the one that looks like a cartoon thought balloon. It's the second from the left. If you click on that icon, you can submit a question. And a few times during the webcast, we'll be coming back to you to answer some of your questions. So now I'd like to turn it over to Dean Harry Katz, who will introduce today's guest and begin our conversation on policy.
Thank you, Joe. There's nothing more important to the U.S. economy than the state of the labor market. Almost every day we hear reports about what the unemployment rate is and what job growth is, and it's central to the performance of the labor market, but as well it affects family income and economic growth. We thought it would make sense, therefore, for our first policy webinar to be focused on the state and performance of the labor market, and we couldn't think of anyone more fitting to discuss those matters with than Seth Harris, who's the Deputy Secretary of Labor, and also, we're proud to say, a graduate of the ILR School. A little bit about Seth, and then we'll get into the material. Before joining the Department of Labor, Seth served as a professor of law at New York Law School and was the director of its labor and employment law programs. Prior to joining the Obama administration and teaching at the law school, Seth also had served for 7 years in the Department of Labor during the Clinton administration. Seth, in addition to being a graduate of ILR, has a law degree from NYU, and he's also well-known for all his experience in different facets of the labor market. I could go on highlighting different aspects of his career that have built his knowledge base, but instead of using up our time on that, I'll go right into our questions and first just say how pleased I am to be here with Seth, and thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule. So my first question is a more personal one, and that is to Seth. You were nominated to the post as Deputy Secretary of Labor in February 2009. In that month alone, 700,000 Americans lost their jobs. And with such a difficult path in front of you, what motivated you to answer President Obama's call to action? What made you believe you could make a difference in addressing that difficult set of issues?
Well, first of all, let me say thank you very much for having me, Harry, and it's a pleasure to be with my friends from the ILR School and everybody else who's participating in the webcast today. For those of us who care about working families, whose lives are really dedicated to the cause of helping working families, the question sort of answers itself. Mm-hmm. This is the worst, we experienced the worst economic times in seven decades, coming out of the Bush administration, early on in the Obama administration. And so if you're committed to trying to improve the lot of working families, then this is the best time, mm-hmm. frankly, to participate, to dive in. I should also say I felt a little bit of a sense of responsibility. I had begun advising then-Senator Obama's Senate staff mm-hmm. back in 2006. In 2007, I signed up with his presidential campaign. I chaired his Labor Policy Committee. I chaired his Disability mm-hmm. Policy Committee. During the transition, I oversaw the transition in 15 agencies, including all the labor agencies and the Labor Department. So I felt something of a sense of responsibility. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had advised along the way and that it was incumbent on me and the other people who had participated to try and do our best to implement the policies that the president had proposed during the campaign. We're not done yet. We have a long way to go, but it's been quite a challenging experience so far. The number that you quoted, 700,000 jobs lost in a month, is a shocking number, but even more shocking given that there were six-figure job losses in the months surrounding February of 2009. So we've lost millions and millions of jobs. 15 million Americans are out of work. So, again, for those of us who really care about this issue, this is the time to engage.
Mm-hmm. So clearly, as you've already mentioned, unemployment and job creation are the most important issues to Americans today, and that was evident in November's election results. And what I wanted to ask about are, what are the key policies being pursued across the administration, specifically at the Department of Labor, but even more broadly to address the unemployment problem?
Right. Let me agree with you that unemployment and jobs are the leading issues in our country right now. I think some of the commentators that we're hearing and some of the politicians we hear talking about the election that we just had risk seriously misreading what the American people were trying to tell us. The American people are frustrated that their jobs are at risk, that they've lost jobs, that their homes are at risk, that they've lost their homes. This was not a ratification of a view that we have to aggressively slash government spending. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are trying to interpret the election that way. I think that would be a misreading. It wasn't government spending that caused people to lose their jobs. Mm-hmm. No one lost their job because of too much government spending, because of the Recovery Act, because of stabilizing the financial sector. So there is, I think, a political risk now for those who go forward and try to claim that they have a mandate to radically slash government spending, lay off a bunch more workers, take more money out of the economy, mm-hmm. and deepen the recession. Having said that, we're nowhere near where we want to be. We've been fortunate. We've experienced several quarters now of growth. We've seen now 10 consecutive months of private sector job growth. That is largely, not entirely, but largely a consequence of the fact that the Obama administration was very successful in stabilizing a financial sector mm-hmm. that really was at risk of implosion. There was some question, I think, early on whether or not we were going to be able to bring some of these large institutions that are essential to financing capital in the United States, keep them from bankruptcy, keep them from in some cases, liquidation. So I think one of the most critical job stabilization efforts was the effort to stabilize the financial services sector. The Recovery Act was another very important part of the program. The Recovery Act has created or saved 3.5 million jobs, not as much as we needed. It turned out, when we were crafting the Recovery Act during the transition, that we underestimated to some extent how deep this recession was going to be. Mm-hmm. Christy Romer, who was the president's chair of the Council of Economic Advisors, has talked about that at some length. I don't think we realized what the depth of job loss was going to be, how deep the jobs recession was going to be. So the Recovery Act did its job. It did its job well. It kept people in jobs and helped jobs to grow. But we're not there yet. We have a lot more that we need to do. At the Labor Department, we're not really a job-creating agency. Right. We're much more a labor supply agency. But we can help with job creation by, first of all, when we have structural unemployment, assuring that workers are able to transition smoothly into new jobs, mm-hmm. either by acquiring the skills that they need to have to succeed in those jobs, or just by getting placement assistance, mm-hmm. dealing with some of the friction that we find in the labor market. But also we're able, in some limited circumstances, to provide various forms of wage subsidy so that workers can be trained through the kind of experiential learning mm-hmm. that we were talking about just a little bit before mm-hmm. we started the webcast. So putting workers into apprenticeship programs, helping workers to get into on-the-job training programs, helping workers mm-hmm. to get into internship programs, and funding the subsidies for those kinds of programs, we think is a very important part of the transition. Employers right now are sitting on about $1.3 trillion in capital. But because there's so much uncertainty in product markets, mm-hmm. they don't know if consumers are going to come back and buy their goods, they're hesitant to invest. So to the extent that we can turn that capital into a decision to hire by lowering the risk to hire, I think that we're going to be able to help folks get back into jobs and help the economy continue to grow.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've already mentioned some of the things the Department of Labor is doing. I wanted to go back a little bit back to last September when the Department of Labor released its six-year strategic plan, and the plan represents a big shift in the focus of the department, both in terms of goals and how you'll measure success moving forward. And I wanted just to link some of the discussion you've already provided about efforts to address current issues with this broader, longer-term plan in the Department of Labor. What's the plan about, and how's it going?
Right. Well, it's we just put it out at the end of September, yeah. beginning of October. So it's hard to know how it's going. It's been very, very well received. I must say that engaging in a multi-year strategic planning process in the midst of the worst economic recession in seven decades was a difficult process because we were very much caught up, as were all the departments in the government, with the implementation of the Recovery Act.
Right.
And for us, that meant billions of dollars going out through unemployment insurance and hundreds of millions of dollars going out for job training and assuring that workers were safe on construction sites and making sure that they were getting the wages they were entitled to. So that was a tremendous effort. So we had a lot going on. We were juggling a lot of balls all at the same time. I think there are two important innovations in this strategic plan for the Labor Department. The first is that we scrapped the old strategic framework that had been in place for almost a decade and a half. And started to talk instead about workers' lives and how the work that we do improves workers' lives. One of the problems with government, if I may say as somebody who's now prominent in government, one of the problems with government is that government spends a lot of time talking about itself and doesn't spend enough time talking about the people that it serves and the way in which it serves them. So what we wanted to have was an outcome-focused, values-based strategic plan, a plan that talked about how the Labor Department made workers' lives better, made the economy better, helped employers to grow and succeed. And we wanted to do that rooted in the Secretary's values, my values, the President's values, but also the values of the 17,000 people who work for the Department. And now we're in alignment from a values perspective. The Secretary, the President, the staff of the Department, and I are largely in the same place when it comes to the reason why we came to work for the Labor Department. We care about workers, and that's what we're committed to. So the Secretary gave us a strategic vision of good jobs for everyone, which we think captures everyone's values in the organization. And then we deduced from that large-scale vision statement what the elements, what the characteristics of a good job are. You know, rising wages, opportunities for knowledge and skills acquisition, voice in the workplace, fair and diverse workplaces. I won't read the whole list. Folks can go to the Labor Department website and take a look. But then we articulated those characteristics of good jobs as the outcomes that our agencies are responsible for delivering to the American people. So that was one innovation, was talking about workers rather than talking about ourselves. The second is how we're going to measure success. So these outcomes, many of them, are quite difficult to measure and in some cases haven't been measured before. For some of our agencies, their outputs, what they produce, is their outcome. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is, I think, the premier statistical agency in the federal government, it produces reams of very valuable data that folks at the ILR school and elsewhere use. You know, when they put out a data set, if they get it out on time and it's accurate and it's reliable and it's relevant, that's their outcome. Producing that data set is their outcome. When the Employment and Training Administration trains a worker and that worker gets a job and stays in the job and we can count their wages, that's their outcome. For our worker protection agencies, measuring success is much, much harder because knowing how the Occupational Safety and Health Administration or how many workers they've kept from getting killed or hurt or sick in the workplace, that's hard to count. You know, counting how many people didn't violate the Fair Labor Standards Act, that's pretty hard to count. So one of the most important innovations in the strategic plan is how we're going to measure outcomes in the worker protection agencies. And we wrote a paper that's in the strategic plan. It's available to anyone to review. We welcome commentary from scholars at the school, from students at the school, from others in the field, or just observers who are interested in it, talking about how we're now going to go out and measure the effect that our agencies have on assuring that employers are in compliance with the law and the workers are deriving benefits from the law. It's a pretty significant innovation, and if we can succeed in focusing on workers' lives and really measuring whether or not we're improving workers' lives, I think that'll be a real success for the department.
Okay. I want to go on and talk a bit about how the November elections have modified your plans, but before I do, I've been asked to provide some advice to those watching the broadcast. Apparently some of you are reporting some audio feedback problems. And if that's the case, our advice is to make sure you have only one browser open, that having two or more browsers open could be creating that very feedback problem. Many others who are watching the webinar are not having the problem. So that's our advice. So here's now the question about the election. I wanted to ask how November's election, you've already touched on it a bit, but a little bit more about how the election impacted the Department of Labor and even more broadly the administration's labor policies. Has the election led to a change in priorities or more of an emphasis and an urgency regarding the issues within the labor market?
Well, our agenda hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. The question that we're now going to face, because the obviously there's been a changeover in leadership in the House of Representatives, or will be mm-hmm. in about a month, is how we're going to negotiate with the House and the Senate over their pieces of our agenda, the role that they play in us implementing our agenda. Because they bring a different perspective. Some members of mm-hmm. the majority, the new majority in the House, bring a different perspective to these issues than we do. So there'll be a give and take, and there'll be a negotiation. One of the big questions is whether or not we're able to do more with less. My expectation mm-hmm. is that the discussion over federal spending is going to be a difficult one. As I said, a lot of people campaigned on cutting government spending. So we're going to, like the rest of the government, we'll be in a dialogue with our appropriators and with the other folks in Congress about which programs we think succeed best, which we think have the greatest impact. And that's one of the imports of this new strategic plan and the new way that we're doing business, is really holding ourselves accountable and demonstrating which of our programs are successful and why they're successful. That is one of the hallmarks, I think, of the Obama administration, is a very deep commitment to social science research and to a belief in program evaluation and funding those programs that we believe are, and we have evidence to show, are most successful. Many of our programs are now structured in a way to incentivize the best possible performance. Mm-hmm. So as we engage the dialogue with the new leadership in the House and with the reformed Senate, it's going to be incumbent upon us to communicate effectively how we're making workers' lives better. I think it will be easier for them to make decisions consistent with the agenda that we've articulated if we can show that the changes that we propose, the programs that we're advancing, the regulations that we're promulgating are actually going to result in workers' lives being better.
It does seem like there's a dilemma or trade-off regarding short-term versus long-term issues. In the short term, as you emphasized, the administration is, I think, correctly emphasizing, we've got to stimulate the economy. We're not done stimulating the economy, yeah. in part to get that growth and also to further make improvements in the unemployment rate. But there's long-run issues about the deficit, and I think part of the dilemma, I guess, you're talking about in this complex negotiation is how to balance the need for further short-term stimulation when we also pay attention to long-term structural issues, and you've got to do both.
Right. I think that's exactly yeah. right. And, you know, and that's exactly the way the president is approaching yeah. it, is to not to take our eye off the ball with respect right. to the deficit. You know, the level of deficit spending that we've achieved in the last year or two is not sustainable over the long term. At the same time, in order to bring the deficit down, we need to get the economy growing again. Right. We need to get people back to work. Folks need to be paying taxes. Corporations need to be paying taxes. Individuals need to be paying income taxes off of their increased, hopefully increased, earnings. That's the surest way over the long term to get the deficit under control, to get Social Security fully funded, Medicare fully funded, and other programs that we need funded in the way they need to be funded. So there is a balance between cutting and at the same time investing in a way that's going to result mm-hmm. in a growing economy and keep our economy growing in the way it's been growing. We need to accelerate growth if there is a way to do that. You know, if we sustain a 2%, 2.5% GDP rate, it's going to be very difficult to bring unemployment down over the long term. So one of the questions that we face is how can we help to get folks back to work so that they can be more productive, that we can inspire more corporate investment of this $1.3 trillion in capital that they're holding onto that I discussed. how do we achieve that without massive new spending, mm-hmm. or perhaps by redirecting some of the spending that we have to other purposes?
Mm-hmm. You've already touched on the important role the Department of Labor plays in workforce development, and I just wanted to tie that back to the strategic plans and focus of the Department of Labor. And which programs in particular, programs oriented towards workforce training, are you and Secretary Solis most proud of? Which ones seem to be generating the most success so far? Is it in particular industries or particular types of workers or particular types of incentives and programs that are working best?
Right. Well, I can easily tell you the program that Secretary Solis is proudest of. When she was in Congress, she sponsored the Green Jobs Act, which was to provide funding to help, particularly through labor management partnerships, workers to get training in emerging technologies and in other green industries. We were able to include in the Recovery Act $500 million for training focused on green jobs, largely through labor management partnerships. It's hard to know whether or not those programs have been fully successful yet, because they just got their money not long ago, and they're now in the process of training folks, and hopefully we'll see outcomes shortly. But the task with respect to green jobs is to prepare workers for jobs that are sustainable, that help us with our energy independence, but also that can't be offshored. That's one of the big challenges that for the United States right now is to build jobs that are going to last, that where workers can't invest in human capital for some extended period of time, be in the job for 5 years, and then the job gets offshored. Workers need to know that their investment in human capital is going to give them a significant return over the long term, give them economic security, give them opportunities for career ladders and development of other kinds. So I think that's the program that Secretary Solis would absolutely point to, that she cares about most and is most proud of, and is helping to restructure the job training infrastructure in our country to focus on the kind of jobs I was just describing. I would add to that, I agree, and then I would add to that another innovation, which is called the Innovation Fund. Mm-hmm. We're working now with Congress and with the Education Department, and also with our authorizers who are trying to reauthorize the Workforce Investment Act, which is the law that authorizes the workforce investment system around the country. It's about 3,000 one-stop centers. It's about 500 workforce investment boards, a rich and diverse and large system that we run. And then there's a system also that's run by the Education Department that's a complementary system. What the innovation funds will do is, and this may be an oxymoron, you'll correct me if it is, we're trying to institutionalize innovation in this system. We want to fund, almost through a venture capital approach, trying new things that will help workers to get trained quickly, get trained successfully, get trained regardless of where they start, if it's a disadvantaged youth or a disadvantaged adult or a dislocated worker or a displaced homemaker, that they can get the training that they need to move quickly into a new job, but also to take ideas that have already been developed and have been successful in particular parts of the country and to try and scale those up nationally. So, for example, my wife is from central Pennsylvania. The snack food capital of the United States is Lancaster, Pennsylvania. It's where all the great pretzels in our country come from. Don't want to insult anybody else's part of the country, but very important pretzel manufacturing and other kinds of snack foods. They have a very innovative joint training effort where all of the corporations in the area that are in the snack food industry take a sectoral approach with their workforce investment board to assuring that workers have the skills that they will need regardless of which company they end up working for. So this sectoral approach and regional approach is the kind of thing you could imagine trying to scale up in other places where you have concentrations of industries organized regionally or in several states, so that workers can move among employers but also have skills that are transferable and make them readily employable regardless of where they go.
Makes a lot of sense. So I'm going to ask Seth one more question, and then before I pause and take some questions from the audience. So I want to encourage those of you who haven't yet submitted questions to do so now, and Joe Zappala is going to accumulate those, and we'll turn to those after I ask Seth about the aging workforce. That's another key change in our economy, is people like us getting older and even more older than we are. And I know the Department of Labor and the administration is concerned about that. And again, I want to ask, you know, what particular strategies or programs do you see working best as we try and integrate the older workforce more fully into them, continue to give them opportunities, even if they're part-time or temporary opportunities? Right. How do we meet the needs of that elder workforce?
Well, I agree with you that this is a very important development in our economy. I would say that there are two important things that have happened. One is large numbers of workers who had been in long-term what we had heretofore thought were career jobs because of the economic dislocations of the 90s and also most recently, found themselves out of work.
I would think and some of those are in the manufacturing.
Manufacturing is one of the industries where you saw it. For example, the significant right-sizing, the downsizing of the auto industry in the United States resulted in large numbers of workers who had been employed in manufacturing, in auto manufacturing for 20 or 25 years, either being giving early out, you know, early retirement, being buyout packages, or simply being laid off with some kind of a severance. And so that's one interesting and important development. The second thing is what I think is an attitudinal change among workers of, let's say, our age cohort. I now identify myself as being in that age cohort. And the attitudinal change is that I think we're seeing it now is, you know, in our parents' generation, when you were had tipped over into your 50s, you know, you're beginning to look at retirement, perhaps, as the next stage in your life. But for workers of our age now, late 40s, 50s, I think that they aren't done yet. I think that they're actually quite resilient. They're looking for the next big thing in their lives. They're looking to do something even more significant with their lives, even if it means reskilling, reconsidering, you know, re-engineering their lives in some significant way, certainly their careers. So there's been a change in the way folks think about not aging, because I don't think they think of it as aging. I think they think of it as living, you know, living out the rest of their lives.
So it's an aspect of even more mobility in the labor market, in a sense, people moving at a later stage, whereas we often think, oh, it's movement is only in your early stage, and then you're locked in. You're bringing out people in their 50s and 60s are moving, even not necessarily geographically, but moving in terms of where they are, who they work for, even what occupation they
I think that's exactly right. I think they're folks are rethinking both the latter stages of their careers and maybe taking on a new career, but also I think they're rethinking retirement. I think the model that many of us have in our heads from our parents' generation of at 65 you're going to go to Florida, live on a golf course, and that's what you're going to do all day long, I think those a lot of folks in that age demographic, some for economic reasons, some because they have no choice, but many because they're just not ready to retire, are really looking for a next chapter. So
how can the government help? Is it portability of pensions or other matters in which the government can help that process?
It's a very important question, and there are a lot of pieces to it. One piece of it is what you mentioned, which is workforce development. You know, our workforce investment system serves 39 million people. Many of them are older workers, but we also have a grant program called the Aging Worker Initiative, which goes out to the one-stops in an effort to get them to focus on older workers. We also have a joint initiative with the Small Business Administration, which is to help the Small Business Administration access workers who've lost their jobs so that those workers can get entrepreneurship training, because that's, again, another way of rewriting your career is to go into undertake an entrepreneurial opportunity rather than a traditional employment relationship. For workers who have a weaker labor force attachment, low-wage workers, maybe lesser-skilled workers, there's a program called the Senior Community Service Employment Program, CSEP, which funds public service employment of varying kinds for these workers, basically to try to give them some history of work, some history of labor market attachment, help them qualify for Social Security benefits, but also to give them some commitment to work so that they can maybe sustain themselves beyond the life of the program. So we're trying in a bunch of different ways. I think ultimately what we have to do is listen to the older workers and let them tell us what it is that they need in preparing. You know, a worker, for example, I'll give you an illustration of that point. Congress just gave us $2 billion over 4 years for a program called the Trade Adjustment Assistance Community College Program. And it's a program that's designed to help community colleges build capacity by developing programs that will serve principally, not exclusively, trade adjustment-assisted eligible workers, workers who've lost their jobs because of trade. If you think about a worker who's 52, 53, 55, who's lost their job in a manufacturing industry because of trade, it's hard to imagine that worker going back for a four-year degree or even for a two-year degree. They're looking for some shorter-term training opportunity, skills development opportunity that will help them to transition into a new job, a new career, a new path and do it quickly, even if they do that at a community college. Mm-hmm. Now, it may end up being a stackable credential, something mm-hmm. that will build them towards an associate's mm-hmm. degree or a bachelor's degree. But in the first instance, particularly if they have a family, they may not be all that interested in going for a multi-year process mm-hmm. of getting more education. So this program is as much for those older workers as it is for the kids who are going into community college for the first time, mm-hmm. coming out of high school, where we're building capacity to make them more successful in remedial education or distance learning or whatever programs the schools decide to develop. So we have to let the workers decide mm-hmm. what path they're going to take. We have to make sure that all of those paths are available to them and that they're going to be successful and lead to labor mm-hmm. market success.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So as promised, let me open it up to questions that may have been submitted by you in the audience, and I'll turn to Joe Zappala to provide some of those.
Great. So we're getting lots of questions. Thanks, everybody. They're burning up the internet waves here. So let me throw out this question. It comes from Reed Bowman. It's on compliance training, and he asks, do you see the Department of Labor adopting regulations or policies encouraging employers to provide training to supervisors and or employees on wage and hour matters?
First of all, Reed, thank you very much for the question. I actually think it's unlikely that we would regulate in that way, but part of the Labor Department's task is to help to educate employers and give employers materials that they can use to educate their managers, their supervisors, their employees, to help them understand how to come into compliance with the law, not just wage and hour law, but occupational safety and health law, pension law, and other laws that we administer. We are, however, taking a new approach to regulation in the department that is premised on the idea that I think is implied by your question, Reed, and that is employers have the responsibility for coming into compliance with the law. If you look at the various employment laws that the Labor Department administers, in each case, Congress assigned the responsibility for compliance to employers. They didn't have in mind a sort of catch-me-if-you-can game where the Labor Department would, you only had to comply if the Labor Department showed up at your doorstep and forced you to comply. So the kind of training that you're talking about in your question fits very well with this concept of employers taking responsibility, training their supervisors so you don't end up with inadvertent violations of the law or systemic violations of the law. So I could see that kind of training program being part of this larger plan, prevent, protect approach that we're taking.
Great. We'll take another question, and then we'll get back to the conversation. Yeah. And we will be coming back to a few more questions before the end of the broadcast. This question comes from Michael Rose. The subject is employer perspective. Some critics accuse the Labor Department as being hostile to business and burdensome to employers with new regulations. How do you respond to that? How does the department balance the needs of employers while still ensuring that it is, as you mentioned, making workers' lives better?
Mike, thank you for the question, Michael. You're right that that's a criticism that we often face. I must admit to being a little perplexed by the criticism because I don't see the kind of burdensome, over-the-top regulation that we're sometimes accused of imposing. Many of the laws that we administer have been in place for many, many years. The Fair Labor Standards Act is 75 years old. Many of the anti-discrimination laws that we enforce were passed during the civil rights era of the 1960s. So we're not creating a huge mountain of new regulations for employers. We view our role as achieving compliance. In the worker protection agencies, our role is to achieve compliance and to work with employers to accomplish that. And there are many different strategies that will produce that desired outcome. In some places, for example, we send teams of consultants out to employers' workplaces to help them to come into compliance. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, for example, funds a large program that provides small businesses with consultative advice on how to comply with the OSHA Act and other laws. We provide a mountain of compliance assistance material on our website, including expert systems called e-laws that advise employers how to come into compliance. You know, we're not interested in the gotcha game. What we're interested in is employers taking responsibility and assuring that they're in compliance with the law. And I think, frankly, that the alums of the ILR school, particularly those who are working in the human resources field, have a critical role to play in that endeavor. bringing employers into compliance, but doing it in a way that fits with the managerial priorities of the organization is the best way to assure sustainable compliance with the law. And that's the role of a human resources professional. And so I'm eager to see the folks inside employer organizations, compliance officers, human resources professionals, compensation specialists, executive compensation specialists, play a leadership role in these organizations to make sure that compliance with the law is not only achieved, but is reconciled and even integrated with the employer's profit-making managerial strategies. In that way, if we can achieve that, if you can achieve that working with us, I think we're much more likely to achieve our mission of compliance with the law, and employers are much more likely to succeed, I think, in their market.
Those are two good questions, and as Joe Zappala mentioned, we'll take a few more questions from the audience in a little bit. I got just a couple more questions for Seth, focusing on other aspects of the labor market, and one of those is the returning vets. When President Barack Obama took office, there were two wars going on, one in Iraq and one in Afghanistan, and those wars have generated another generation of returning soldiers. And what's the Department of Labor doing to, and even more broadly, the administration doing to assist returning vets as they try to reengage in the workforce and the workplace?
Right. This is a very high priority for the president. Let me also say it's a very high priority for the First Lady, who's deeply engaged with military families and promoting their interests in the administration. I can tell you I've been called into the First Lady's staff office several times to have conversations about this subject. The Labor Department plays a leadership role on veterans employment. We have an organization called the Veterans Employment and Training Service. And so it is working with the Veterans Administration and also with the Department of Defense, the Small Business Administration, the Treasury, and other organizations to try to help veterans transition from military employment into civilian employment. We have a number of programs that are designed to do that. First of all, I should say the president signed an executive order which made employing veterans a high priority for the federal government as an employer. So we're going to play a big role in that, and we're constantly engaged in employing vets at the Labor Department. We have a large veterans population at the department. And we're also working with the Department of Defense and the VA and the Office of Personnel Management in creating a nationwide online portal, working with the private sector, but also for government employers like us, to give veterans access to employers and to give employers access to veterans. So that's a large-scale initiative that we're all going to be working on together. We have several programs that are designed to help veterans get into civilian employment, transition into civilian employment. We start with active duty service members, Guard and Reserve, with a program called the Transition Assistance Program. We're responsible for the employment part of the Transition Assistance Program, and we essentially train these service members how to market themselves to employers in the private sector through a variety of means. And we served 125,000 active duty service members last year. That number is going to go up as more and more folks are decommissioned and brought back home. The next step in that process is once folks transition out of the military or back home if they are Guard or Reserve, we connect them with the Jobs for Veterans State Grants Program. I talked before about this large workforce investment system that we have, which has almost 3,000 one-stops around the country. Well, in most of those one-stops, there are dedicated personnel for veterans. Their job is to help veterans, particularly veterans with disabilities and other veterans who have particular challenges, to get the services that they need through the one-stop system. There is a priority of service in the one-stop system and in the workforce investment system for veterans. So if you're a veteran coming home, you go to the front of the line with the other veterans in getting services that are provided or funded by the Labor Department. And then for those veterans who struggle and fall into homelessness, we have a homeless veterans reintegration program. Again, our job is to help those folks get back into the labor market, transition into the labor market, get the services they need so they can succeed in the labor market, the skills development that they need, the supportive services that they need, which is very important. A lot of folks who are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan are suffering from a variety of traumatic injuries, traumatic brain injury, PTSD, other things. They need services beyond just employment services, and part of our job is to help them get those services. So there's a comprehensive, large-scale effort. I expect we're going to see an announcement from either the President or the First Lady in the next couple of months that'll address this issue in a little bit more detail. We're very deeply involved in that. Again, a very high priority for the president.
I also want to talk about the disabled population more broadly. You've already mentioned the disabled vets, and I know you personally have been heavily involved in legal and other issues concerning those with disabilities. And the ILR School and many other universities work with the Department of Labor in trying to improve the employment prospects for the disabled. And again, my question is, what seems to be working the best for the Department of Labor? What kinds of programs do you have, in addition to those you've already mentioned, that are targeted on assistance to the disabled?
Right. Well, this is an issue that I care about a great deal. Before I became Deputy Secretary of Labor, I was a disability scholar, in addition to being a labor and employment law scholar at New York Law School, and I worked with a number of organizations, including United Cerebral Palsy and others, and I've had the opportunity to work with Suzanne Bruyere and Andrew Houghtonville and some of the other folks at EDI, at the ILR School, a terrific organization advancing scholarship in disability. So this is an issue I've been involved in fairly deeply. We have a number of things going on, including the only dedicated governmental organization focused on disability employment. We have the Office of Disability Employment Policy, which has, I think, really been revivified under this administration. And we have a very successful partnership with Senator Harkin, who's very deeply committed on disability issues. He chairs both our authorizing committee in the Senate and our appropriations subcommittee. So he has a lot of say in these issues, and he should, because he cares a great deal about them. The initiative that I'm most interested in and that I think can make the biggest difference is a $20 million initiative that is a joint project of our Office of Disability Policy and the Employment and Training Administration called the Disability Employment Initiative. Mm-hmm. The goal of that initiative is to help SSDI and SSI recipients who are being served in our workforce investment system to get the best quality services, well-funded services, and the supports that they need through our system. You know, this is a huge system, and we already serve a lot of SSI and SSDI recipients. And if we can help them transition off of these public assistance programs and help to reduce the cost of those public assistance programs with a small investment in workforce investment by engaging them through the one-stop system, we think that can be a big part of a solution to this high non-employment rate we have among people with disabilities. What Suzanne and the other folks at EDI would tell you is that the employment rate, not the unemployment rate, but the employment rate among people with disabilities is about 22%. And there are a number of causal factors. One of them is that it is very difficult, once you are on a cash assistance program like SSDI or SSI, to get off. There was a long time when you were risking your health care if you left, but also you sort of in the SSDI program, at least, you drop off a cliff if you earn too much money. You just are out of the program completely.
You're penalized for working.
Exactly. Yeah. So, and in order to get on those programs, you essentially have to prove yourself incapable of work. The proof level is so high that you have to essentially disqualify yourself for employment. So the likelihood that you could disqualify yourself and then a year or 2 years later qualify yourself for employment makes it very, very difficult. So this program, where we're making the one-stop system more accessible to SSDI and SSI recipients and other workers with disabilities, we think will be a big help. You know, one of the, in addition to the public assistance issue, one of the biggest issues for workers with disabilities is educational attainment. As a general matter, workers with disabilities have a lower educational attainment than workers who don't have disabilities. And in our economy, you know this better than most, what you earn is largely determined by what you learn. So we need to focus on K through 12 education, and the president invested over $12 billion in IDEA. We need to focus on vocational rehabilitation, because that's an important part of assuring that workers with disabilities can succeed in the educational system and beyond. But we also have to assure that after people with disabilities become working age, that they have access to the programs that help workers without disabilities succeed in the labor market. So that's what we're trying to accomplish.
Okay. Now I want to see if there's additional questions from the audience. And then that'll give us just a little bit of time for one final question before we do our wrap-up.
Great. So I'm trying to, we got many, many questions, and I believe Dean Katz will say, will tell you before we close some plans that we're going to intend to follow to try to respond to those questions. So we're trying to identify some things we haven't touched on.
Sure.
So here's a question about healthcare worker training, which seems kind of interesting. It comes from Debbie Friedman, and she asked, as healthcare is changing, new technology moved to outpatient care, and staff will be required to have new, different, and or advanced education, how can the various programs that you've discussed support the incumbent workers and help them to upgrade to these new skills and gain new knowledge?
Right, and I'm going to out Debbie as one of the leaders of one of the most impressive healthcare training programs at 1199, SEIU's Local 1199 here in New York, a tremendously successful program that they run with the League of Voluntary Hospitals. So, Debbie, that's a great question, and I know that you're playing a leadership role in trying to solve it. Let me talk a little bit about how we've invested in healthcare training. You're exactly right that healthcare is one of the few industries that has grown during this very difficult economic recession. And so there are job opportunities for workers at every level in the healthcare industry, and part of our task is to assure that workers have the skills they need in order to be able to succeed. Congress gave us, as part of the Recovery Act, $250 million for high growth and healthcare job training. And so we have been able to give out grants around the country that are targeted at training workers for RN, LPN, other kinds of healthcare worker jobs. And the task is not merely to assure that workers are able to get into the industry, but that they're able to build career ladders in the industry and continue to succeed in the industry over the long term. So those grants are at least in part dedicated to that purpose. It's also a part of what we're doing in our in the Job Corps. We're transitioning part of the Job Corps to focus on healthcare training, and also in our ordinary job training workforce investment system that the dean and I have been talking about. Throughout the country, there are opportunities, and so as employers make themselves available to the workforce investment system and let us know that there are job opportunities there and let their local community colleges know that there are job opportunities there, we're able, through this workforce investment system, to provide funding for those programs and to put workers directly into the training that they need in order to be able to succeed in healthcare. So I agree with you. It's an important priority.
Maybe we'll take one more question from the audience. And
sure.
Then we'll...
This question wanted to ask Deputy Secretary Harris to comment on strategies being explored regarding how jobs can be moved back to the U.S. Mm-hmm. by leading companies here who move jobs overseas to reduce costs.
Well, this has been a priority of the President since the campaign. We have a role in this, but we may not have the largest role. An important part of assuring that employers stay in the United States or move back to the United States is assuring that they have a skilled workforce and that they are able to get the workers that they need in order to be able to produce effectively. And so to the extent that we're investing in not only in our workforce investment system, but also in our community college program and bringing disadvantaged youth and making them available for employers, we're contributing to helping employers who have offshore jobs to bring those jobs back. Now, that's only, of course, one part of the puzzle. I think it's a much more complicated and large puzzle than that. One important part of the puzzle is tax policy and whether or not employers essentially benefit under our tax system for offshoring jobs. Another part is simply cost, transportation costs for manufacturing, for example, are rising, if energy costs are rising, there is a benefit to employers to locate back in the United States. So there are a lot of factors that weigh in. We're doing our best to assure that the human capital factor points employers in the direction of siting their businesses here and training and employing workers here in the United States.
Well, we had a lot of terrific questions we didn't have time to get to submitted by the audience, and I want to assure those in the audience, Seth has kindly agreed that he and his staff will try and respond to the questions where they can after this session, and we'll assist in that, getting you the best response we can. I just had one little short question.
Sure.
It's a big question, but we don't have much time, so
sure.
We'll just as short but a response as we can get, and that is just that A lot of what we talk about are the troubles that we face. That's the nature of the beast. Economics is the dismal science, and yet you seem to remain optimistic and hopeful. And I just wanted to ask, what keeps you optimistic about the performance of the U.S. economy and where things are headed?
Yeah, I am actually quite optimistic. And it's admittedly a little bit hard to do that because this has been a very rough time. A lot of families are suffering terribly. But what's been impressive to me is how resilient the American worker is. Folks are working very, very, very hard to support their families. Some of them are working two and three jobs. If they lose their job through no fault of their own, they are doing their best to both to seek a new job, and if they need new skills, to go out and get the skills that they need. If they need placement assistance, they're working hard to get the placement assistance they need. I think that American workers are telling us that they're not done, that they see hope, that they see a future for themselves and for their families, and that they're going to do what's necessary to succeed. So I have a tremendous amount of faith in the American worker and the American economy. We have recovered from every significant recession and small recession that we've experienced over the last 200 years. Now, we haven't experienced many as deep as this. It's been 70 years since we've seen one as deep as this, and this was a tough one. But workers tell me, as I travel around the country, that they're ready to keep fighting. And really what they're doing is they're fighting for their families. So when I hear that and I see them respond to the effort that we're making to provide them with the services that they need, I have a lot of hope for the future. I think workers understand that it's not government's job to make it all come out right. It's to provide them with the resources that they need to make things come out right so that they can make things come out right. And if, as I said before, if we can give them a choice of paths to success, multiple ways of getting to success, and we can assure them that the laws that Congress passed that embody the values that they're committed to are going to be complied with, that they're going to get the wage they're entitled to, that they're going to get the pension that they've been promised, that they're going to get the health care that they've been promised, that they're going to be able to go to work and arrive back home that night whole, healthy, not worrying their families about whether or not they're ever going to come home. I think that if we can accomplish that, that the American worker has enough gumption and toughness and spirit and intelligence and drive, that they're going to be able to help us bring the economy back to where we want it to be, to a booming, successful American economy. They've done it before, and I think they're going to do it again.
Well, great. Thanks, Seth. I want to thank you a lot for taking all the time out of, I know, a busy schedule. I want to thank those in the audience. I've learned a lot, even though I've been studying these issues for many years, and I know our audience has too. I also want to remind the audience, as is our style at ILR, this webinar will be archived at the ILR website, and within a few days you'll be able to see it there if you or others in your organization want to make use of it. This is the first of our new online policy series, so stay tuned for announcements you'll get through the internet and through other means about those upcoming webinars. You can also always not only see archived webinars, but find out about upcoming events by visiting our website. That's www.ilr.cornell.edu. Thanks again for participating, and I look forward to further engagements in future webinars. And thanks again to Seth.
Thank you, Harry. Thanks very much.